The following is a meeting with devotees with His Holiness Srila Satsarupa Das Goswami, recorded on June 9, 2002, in Wicklow, Ireland.
A few classes ago, I gave a class showing paintings. And then the last class I gave was Lord Nrisimhadev's appearance day. And I had a small audience. And including Krishnadas and Nimai, who sat very alertly during the whole class, and a few other devotees. And so in that class, I began by telling a story that I think I'm going to tell again, since so many of you weren't here. And it's a vital story, and it will lead into the other material that I want to talk about. So if you were here, I don't think it will be something you needn't hear again. True story. So there was an ISKCON devotee who was attracted to Krishna consciousness by reading Prabhupada's books and associating with Prabhupada's devotees, and then willingly chose ISKCON spiritual master, who he became very attached to and loyally served. And had no doubts about, understood the philosophy that the spiritual master is the link. Krishna sends the spiritual master to represent him. Like you say, the spiritual master should be treated as God because he's a representative of God, and Krishna is more pleased when you serve him than when he's pleased, than if you try to please Krishna directly. So the devotee understood that philosophy and was trying to serve his spiritual master in that way, that this service will take me back to Godhead and will please the Supreme Lord. But sometimes he had some doubts. Let's say this devotee was a very analytical kind of devotee, too, who thought things out in a not simple way, and made analyzed things and tried to connect different things. So he thought, well, my spiritual master is... I have faith he's a representative of Krishna, but I see by his behavior that he's also a person. And so there seems to be a kind of a duality. By person, he didn't mean that he saw the spiritual master committing aparads or offenses, but it was a person different than the disciple was, a different... tastes and even ways of thinking. We all have, our minds work in different ways. And he said that sometimes his spiritual master's mind worked in a different way than his did. So it became a bit of a mental problem how to see his Guru Maharaj as the Acharya sent by Krishna and yet as a person. In this world, flesh and blood, a person with idiosyncrasies, let's say, rather than say faults. So he didn't want to ask a spiritual master because he thought a spiritual master would be hurt by that question. So he was really kind of locked alone with it, didn't know what to do. And so he asked another devotee, who he considered a Shiksha guru, and who was also a friend of his initiating spiritual master, in a not in a big open confessional way, but just in passing in a letter, and got this reply. Hare Krishna, I read your letter. I can understand your thoughts, although I can't claim to know as much about the situation as to make my own judgment. I personally tend not to analyze those kinds of problems in others. I tend to just accept whatever is happening as what's happening. I take it that you know more than me about this situation, and that you, out of affection and concern, have reached your own conclusions. I can't comment much, but I will comment a bit. I do know that you fear crossing the border between seeing him as Guru Maharaj, the person, and Guru Maharaj, your Guru Maharaj. I know that fear well. Now, he's referring to this fear because he's had it himself in regards to Srila Prabhupada, where you might think nobody would tread that far, but it happens to us, to Prabhupada's disciples and other devotees, that they certainly see Srila Prabhupada as a colossal pure devotee who started this Krishna consciousness movement, founder Acharya. But when they hear different things, like Prabhupada calls a disciple a buffalo brain or something, or he gets very angry, is he always showing us an ecstatic symptom, or is he actually angry or annoyed? Is he entitled to such human feelings, or are they all something that must be considered perfectly transcendental and not with any individual personality? So this devotee says, I have problems like that too, sometimes seeing Prabhupada act and wondering of him as a person and as the perfect guru. So I know that fear, crossing the border. But you there are stuck with your conclusions, which you cannot honestly deny. I've noted there are actually two things going on in dealing with one's spiritual master. First is that he is a person. Second, even in the perfect spiritual world, Narada Muni is a person, Shiva is a person, Radharani is a person, Chandramuli, Chandravali is a person, Sridham is a person, and that Brahmin boy. What? Maromangal. He's very much a very different kind of person. So both are true simultaneously, and we are recommended to always see that Krishna is working through him. Seeing him as not different from Krishna, yet he is a person. Somewhat of a paradox, I think. But by trusting that Krishna is always manifesting something to us through that person, we can make advancement. That seems to be the system that Krishna uses. Quote, worship me through the person of your spiritual master. Although he is certainly a person like you are a person, his purity of heart, and that you've accepted him, makes him my vehicle, something like that. I've heard Prabhupada say that everyone knows that the deity is made of stone, but to consider that the deity is only made of stone is an offense. I think it's the same with one's spiritual master and his personhood, his personal characteristics. I'm also learning to separate the person with his conditioned nature and his sincerity, his purity, And Prabhupada himself said that he was not omniscient, he didn't know everything like Paramatma. But someone was saying, does a pure devotee, meaning Prabhupada, if he knows everything, how come sometimes he forgets Sanskrit verses and things like that, as Prabhupada does in his lectures? So Prabhupada said his perfection is not like Paramatma, but that he's completely surrendered to Krishna. What we may learn from our spiritual master is sometimes only the full-hearted sincerity of his attempt at service. Perhaps sometimes that is what we are learning, as opposed to the specific things that he is saying. That's interesting. You listen to a lecture by spiritual master. When we say spiritual master, we can say any sincere Vaishnava. And what we're hearing is not only, say, the story of when Indra killed Vritasura, and we're listening with faith, but we're learning and hearing the sincerity of the devotee's faith and his attempt to convey Krishna consciousness to us and help us. I think that you can have your opinions, and you have the right as a sincere disciple to present them, and he has the right to serve Krishna in his way. His right takes preference over your right. I often think that a condition that I see in others is at least also something within myself reflected in that person. I check that while reaching my conclusions. I think that's all I can say at the present on the subject. So, so that's what I read last week. Our last class, but the class before that, which many attended, was a kind of a heavy class, which I was talking about the relevance of the spiritual master and the disciple, and how there was a tendency for it to become irrelevant, not important. When that would happen, when the disciples wouldn't follow their vows that they made to the spiritual master. Four rules and 16 rounds, so that eventually it wouldn't become an important relationship. If you remember how I gave that class, I started out reading from Every Day Just Right about Guyana, and all of a sudden I stopped, and I said I want to speak about something else, because it was more pressing to me. I asked a few devotees. I asked Uddhava, what did the devotees think about the class? And he said, spiritual master has a right to say what he wants. He said some devotees were taken aback. He said, I thought they didn't expect to hear this kind of thing from you. But I got one letter that I wanted to read from Abai, which was not so much just on the topic of relevance of the guru to the disciples, but on the appreciation for a devotee to speak what he's really thinking, and speaking from the heart. And if we do this, this would be the real loss of relevance. If we get together and the devotee just recites the philosophy and doesn't say what's really on his mind. My main reason for writing this note is to express my feeling in response to last week's class. I really appreciate how you spoke out from your heart. This is exactly what makes this relationship so relevant, that you show how much it means to you, not just on the level of duty, but in a heartfelt human way, which is to me the essence of what Krishna consciousness is ultimately about. Loving relationships, that you care enough to think and talk this way strikes a chord in my heart that pulls out my loving response to you. And yet, what I had to say, it wasn't so much giving out sweet expressions. I was speaking with some reprimand and a little resentment. But she said that she felt that I cared enough to speak what I really felt. Drew her. Your words last week were like a hook that embedded itself more deeply in my heart and keeps tugging on it. All I can think of since is, I want to be with you, Guru Maharaj, on your side, one of your men. I want to really line myself up in your camp and show you my support and my love, not just in words, but in deeds. You have tolerated a lot of nonsense from me. Now I want to say that that is over. I'm suffering from my weakness and learning a hard lesson, but grateful for it. Thank you for always carrying the beacon for me and for all of us, always maintaining the lonely position on the top of the mountain while we dally in the valley. Now I want to keep climbing up that mountain with all the other good souls who engage you by their efforts. I hope that as you witness my struggle to join you, it will relieve some of the loneliness of your position. I greatly appreciate, value, and admire you, and often think how pleased Krishna and Prabhupada must be with you. Irrelevant is a word that could never be applied to you in my life, but I also must take care not to take the sacrifices you are making for granted. Thank you for being you and sharing that special you with me and all your disciples. One of the aspects of relevant was that if the spiritual master, he's not forced to follow the rules and regulations. He wants to, but if by his example others don't, then there's an irrelevancy. I'd like to take this even further and say that some devotees may consider the relationship irrelevant because Krishna consciousness has not become so important to them. It's not just a personality thing with me. They just don't care anymore. And so whatever Krishna consciousness they have or don't have, that's good enough. And they don't want to be prodded to go further. Whether it's by the spiritual master or anyone. So I realize we're all struggling. So before I put any pressure on you in that direction, I wanted to give you the lenient line that's contained in Srimad Bhagavatam about this. There's a verse spoken in the conversations by Narada with Vyasa. Narada, the guru, says, "My dear Vyasa, even though a devotee of Lord Krishna sometimes falls down, somehow or other, he certainly does not undergo material existence like other fruitive workers, because a person who has once relished the taste of the lotus feet of the Lord can do nothing but remember that ecstasy again and again." Prabhupada says, "A devotee of the Lord automatically becomes uninterested in the enchantment of material existence because he is rasa graha, or one who has tasted the sweetness of the lotus feet of Lord Krishna. There are certainly many instances where devotees of the Lord have fallen down due to uncongenial association, just like fruitive workers who are always prone to degradation. But even though he falls down, a devotee is never to be considered the same as a fallen karmi. A karmi suffers the results of his own fruitive reactions, whereas a devotee is reformed by chastisement directed by the Lord himself." So that's as long as we stay at least within the circle of a devotee who's struggling, but is, he may be breaking the rules, but he's trying to be a devotee rather than one who completely rejects Krishna consciousness. So it's very consoling to hear that Krishna says that the fallen devotee is not treated like the non-devotee. He's given special ways to purge himself. They may be sometimes a little medicinal. There's this beautiful sentence, the sufferings of an orphan and the sufferings of a beloved child of a king are not one and the same. The king may give a little chastisement to his son, but who's going to take care of the orphan? Nobody to improve his lot. So we have to try. That's the point. Even though we're not following. If I was saying, last time I was saying there's no relevance if there's no following, I would say, modified, say there's no relevance if there's no trying. it would be nice if we could remember, one way to focus on this is to remember when we were very enthusiastic, and that was usually at the time when we joined this movement. I remember stories that devotees have told me here, how Hare Krishna Dasi used to not be allowed to chant her beads, and she would go on walks with her oiled beads and feel like she was a gopi escaping from the house to chant. And Prabhupada Das would read Bhagavad Gita with a torch under the blankets because he was not allowed. Anybody else have any remembrances of their very enthusiastic Krishna consciousness?
Yeah, but it's a very difficult state, that beginning. It's like, wow, it's like you have me, it's like meeting me for the first time in this life, and it's just like, and then it goes, then there's loads of transitions. And you hear it theoretically, you think, yes, I have to cut all this off. But,
You mean when you think you have to get rid of all your anarthas, then it gets more dutiful than blissful. I remember when I used to first come here, and it was sort of like a cult and or a family, but there was so much youthfulness and so much enthusiasm. All the men would always be getting together, or the boys, and burst out laughing. And there was so much enthusiasm, and some of it had to go because it was based on false premises of community life. But and we're growing older, so that makes inevitable change. Bhatri told me he was 18 when he joined, and now he's 38. So he just can't think the same or be the same, running around as a Hare Krishna now that you're a middle-aged man with responsibilities of children. And getting food and putting a roof over the head. But I don't think that these kind of changes, say the breakup of the community even, the way that there was a community here too, was very tight, or the I don't think, or youthfulness has to mean a loss of enthusiasm. Some of the devotees didn't want to be identified so much as just a Hare Krishna person, but I remember Uddhava, you said to me once when I was leaving in the airport, and that was just when things were kind of breaking up in the camp sense, and you said, I just want to be a normal person, but a Hare Krishna. Now, but to be a normal person and to be a Hare Krishna, you can still be a very religious and very devoted Hare Krishna in your home, trying to raise your children as Krishna conscious, and yourself practicing, aspiring to love God. There's so many people, even in other religions, who are they don't live in a temple or something, but they're very enthusiastic. So I don't see why we have to lose that or become irrelevant just because our original model is not the same as it used to be, and now that we just become something else first, or something else, and a great neglect of being a devotee. I often quote Shilabhati's line, I'm an actress who wants to be a Hare Krishna devotee. I'm sure there are actresses who are very, very, even though very professional and successful, who are very, very devoted to God. And why can't we have both of these things in our life, and not now I'm into motorcycles, or now I'm into karate, or now I'm into something else, and or I watch some TV, and then all become so complacent about, you know, Krishna consciousness, a spiritual master, and all that. We can be, as we read, we can be forgiven for these things that aren't as things that we wouldn't do when we were so youthful. Oh, you can't do that. You can't eat chocolate. You can't do this. You can't do that. And now we're a little more relaxed. But we should still try hard. So with this in mind, I had a few questions to ask. Why is following Krishna conscious good for us? It's such a basic question. Perhaps we have forgotten. You were saying, you just said, Shilabhati, oh, when we first joined, it was so exciting, it was so wonderful. Some of it was social, you know, that we met these wonderful people we had never met before, and a path of God consciousness. That seemed so exciting. Even that you could dress so wild and act so outrageously for some of us was attractive. But that's not what Krishna consciousness is good for us. It's because it just what it did in the beginning. It cleaned our lives of bad habits. It put us on a true path for the human life, which is to expose the soul and develop his love for God and his knowledge of God. So the relevancy of the spiritual master is perhaps we have forgotten this, and he can help us if we keep contact with him. Now, the negative thing I was mostly talking about in terms of irrelevancy was the lack of austerity. So how can we find taste again in austerity? Do we perhaps have an unclear idea of how a Krishna conscious life can be dynamic? Perhaps we stop struggling against sex desire, for example, because it's too much work. Or we were never convinced about what was wrong with it, and never really winning the battle. It's a tough one. The rules of Krishna consciousness. But in the beginning, I assume devotees did follow it, and many devotees still do follow it. But Prabhupada has this rule that sex is not allowed except in marriage for having children. So what's happened? I don't have the answer to this, but this is a big question. That there is a taste in austerity. I mean, I do have an answer. That that living that life without plunging again into sex acts which really don't please us. That it's a happy life. And it makes us feel honest that we're following the code of Krishna consciousness. It's dynamic to live that way. And but if in the beginning, by lack of knowledge, you never understood what was wrong with it, and there are devotees like that. If you really would press them, they say, "Well, I don't really understand what the point is for renunciation." Then you don't really understand Krishna consciousness, or if you never really won the battle, then that will create irrelevance with the spiritual master, and this is something to try to correct. We have to pray to Krishna, please give me pleasure in my material life without having to engage in sex life, which Krishna says is only for a certain purpose. So, I have another question. What happens with devotees who have not found themselves capable of continuing to chant or follow, and they become ashamed to communicate with you because you're so intent on upholding your own sadhana and practices, they feel no longer a right to communicate with you since they are incapable or unwilling at the time to do what you say. To pretend to do otherwise would be dishonest. Would you want to keep communication with such people? Do you have any advice for devotees who find themselves moving in that direction? No, I like to keep in touch with devotees like that. In fact, when I hear from them, it moves me more than a routine exchange with someone who is like, just got this a routine report, I'm still here, I'm still doing the same thing. I'll give you a couple of examples. I just got a kind of goodbye letter from Mary, sister of Immer. I did send out a letter that I was going to read all letters, but wasn't going to answer as many. And maybe she sent it for that reason too, but I don't think she even got that. But it was kind of a goodbye to me as a person and to Krishna consciousness. Her husband is Christian, and she says when she goes to the Christian church, she doesn't feel very much. But when she went to the temple in Belfast, she doesn't feel like she's part of the club there anymore, as she put it. And she doesn't chant any rounds, and she didn't didn't sound very happy going to live in England. And I felt so much feeling for her. I wrote her a long letter. I said, whatever you are, you know, whatever you become, please keep in touch with me. And I remember you, and you remember when you first came, and we thought it was such a catch for us in Krishna consciousness to that such you know, sweet young girls were joining us, and with such sincere religious enthusiasm, and now we've lost her. So just to have some communication with her as a person, so it's not like if somebody is, you know, writes a letter like that to me, I don't chant anymore. My husband is a Christian. I don't feel like I'm in the club. I feel, okay, write that one off. But I feel even more for a person like that. And I just last week I got a package from a person I hadn't heard from in about 10 years. And I opened it up, and it was a real nice framed Hare Krishna mantra. The words of the Hare Krishna mantra in a frame. And on the back, it said, from Rasada and his wife, they're in Sweden, he said, I'm still trying to keep my head above the water. And I thought, wow. He's still out there. And he still had some feeling for me. He saw somewhere, he saw this Hare Krishna mantra thing, and he wanted to send it to me. So there was a relevance. The Bhagavad Gita states that we should follow the spiritual master's orders, but if we are unable to follow, we should at least not resent the principle. In other words, we shouldn't blame the spiritual master or his orders for our inabilities. Are there attitudes like this that will help us maintain our relationship with you and even draw strength from it despite our failings? Well, it's just a very important truism that we should be humble enough to say, well, you know, take the responsibility. I joined. I wanted to follow those principles. I can't follow them. I can't chant my rounds and surrender. But it's not my spiritual master's fault. I took the vows to him. I can't follow them. But I still love him. I still honor him. I still respect him. That's a good attitude. The other, to blame the guru, like you deprogrammed me, or you got me into this. And I do get some attitudes like that from others, that you taught us these rules, and I see now that they're not relevant, and this was not good, that you and Prabhupada have brought this movement, and so on and so forth. That's offensive to spiritual persons, and we shouldn't fall that low. Even if we can't follow, we should still be friendly. What is the actual relevance of the guru-disciple relationship? It seems that the guru is off doing his practices and the disciple is left to go off to do his or hers. What is it that we're supposed to be exchanging? Krishna Katha, personal disclosures, affection, service. What practical vehicle can these things take in our relationship with you? Well, here in Ireland, I have more intimate relationship with disciples in one way than anywhere. At least I get to see you every 2 weeks. And whereas due to my health limitations, unfortunately, I'm not going around the world to see the other devotees, and they're having to keep their personal relationship with me by reading my books and writing letters. But I just wanted to mention that you shouldn't think that it doesn't work. There are devotees, disciples of mine, I'm speaking personally, but it's true of other spiritual masters, who are in all different places and have very intimate, affectionate relationships, either by the service they're doing or by the attitude they have. In other words, the devotees, a small group of devotees in Florida are operating this Gitanagari Press. It's just a tiny, understaffed group, but whatever is coming out, whatever is being distributed, it's being done by them, and they never get to see me. And then there are devotees, just by their service to Krishna and to the Hare Krishna movement, and feeling a and feeling a kind of solidity and a confirmation of their connection to Prabhupada through me, are able to do a very nice service. I just have some pictures here I got the other day, so I was going to pass them out because you you happen to have seen this devotee. Remember at Inasharatha a few years ago, that devotee came. And he had tattoos all over his body. It's kind of a punk haircut. And not only that, he had tattoos all over his chest and his arms, but then when he bowed down, we saw a huge Nisringadeva on his back. So he probably seemed like a, well, we know that there's a new generation of devotees who just live like that anyway, whatever it's called, hardcore, straight edge. And they do come to Krishna consciousness with sincerity, but they do seem eccentric, and we wonder, you know, what will they actually do for this movement. But this fellow, Dayal Nitai, he lives in Cleveland. He's become a very influential devotee there in preaching, and he writes to me and says, there's another fellow coming to our Wednesday night meetings. He's becoming really interested. I think you'll get a letter from him in a few weeks. And then in a few weeks, I get a letter from him. He says, "Dear so-and-so, Dayal Nitai told me about you. I've been reading your books. Will you accept me as your spiritual master?" And then I get a letter from somebody else like that. He's preaching to all these different people. And to the people of Cleveland, and areas around there, going to all festivals and everything. These are pictures. There's a lot of interracial activities in that city too. And so these are pictures of a daily thing that they do there. It's like a food for life set up with a little tent that they have. And I'll pass it around. But, you know, I write to him. He sends me little trinkets sometimes. What did he send me last time? Beside the toothpicks.
Whatever you want. Socks.
Yeah. Always wants to send some little gift.
Earplugs,
yeah. But he's so enthusiastic. And it's like I don't really have to see them. We're just part of each other's life. There's this other devotee in Philadelphia. You may have seen him now. He's growing a little older. A black devotee, Hariasva. And he owns a two-story restaurant and preaching center on South Street, which is the real hip street in Philadelphia. Also very interracial, and on the second, what we call the second story, he has a preaching center, and on the ground floor he has a restaurant. And this restaurant, his clientele is real high class black Muslims come there, and he's so charismatic, and when he sees a girl come in who he knows, he'll say, "Hiya, darling, how you doing?" And they talk something back to him. And he personally serves the food to the table. He's almost like a dancing waiter. And he has music on all the time, different kinds of jazz or whatever music they want. Now they bring their own CDs in. They say, "Will you please play this?" And he'll sing a few words, a few bars to the songs as he goes around dancing. And people just love Hari Asva. And I think he may come Janmashtami, but he's so he's just affectionate to everyone. But he and I never write letters, but whenever we see each other, we immediately hug and feel so so much love. So the relevance doesn't have to be just how many times did I see you or exactly what was my austerity. I'm not connected with that restaurant, but I am with him and his heart. I have a few more things, but I can stop for questions and answers. Yes.
When Ekalavya, the prince from the Shatra tribe, wanted to have Dronacharya as his martial teacher, he was rejected. And then he went to the forest and he fashioned a murti out of clay or wood. And he was worshipping that murti, and he got some power. He became the best archer in the world. So, do we worship Guru as a person or as a principle? Because he rejected the order of his Guru as a person. He was told not to worship Dronacharya. But he got power by worshipping him as a principle.
Yeah.
So,
but then the power was taken away by the Guru. When the Guru came, he was very angry. He said, I told you that you are not a qualified disciple. Give me your thumb." It's a complicated story, I guess, in terms of the principles involved, but in terms of caste, nowadays it would be a little puzzle for us. Why wouldn't he accept him as a disciple? If he was such a loving, obedient disciple. Some scholars have explained it. I don't know the... I don't really know the explanation, except that that he was disobedient and his power was taken away. So we think nowadays of some of these wild schisms we have in ISKCON. So to say, you can make some analogy that if somebody said he was following Prabhupada and he wasn't, and he appeared to become very powerful, it might not be bona fide, and in the end Prabhupada can take it away, unless he actually is pleasing the spiritual master. He concocted. No. The puzzle is why his Dronacharya was apparently so cruel and strict, but the disobedience was direct. Anyway, we're not really talking about that. We're talking about loving relationships where disciples try to serve. Like if I ask you to follow the four rules and then I find out that you're not, I'm not going to come to your house and cut your thumb off. Or your spiritual master won't. He'll forgive you. He'll say, "You should try harder." He'll be very forgiving. You say, "I disobeyed." And he'll say, "Well, now you must I forgive you, but you must try better. To get Krishna, or you won't get Krishna's full mercy. And neither will you, if you don't follow the rules, neither will you get great power. I'll defy the order, but I'll get great power.
I think you mentioned it before, but it's the point that the spiritual master is a person is the whole point in being there, basically, because we hear about all these great charities and people in the past that often they're very hard to relate to. And he's not like us, but he is a person, so we can relate to his example that he sets because of that. Whereas his Lord Krishna and all these, you know, people in the past, it all just seems so amazing and kind of superhuman, and you read the Bhagavatam, it's this world. This is a person right here with us doing it, so we can see that it can be done.
Right. Yeah. Right.
If he wasn't human or a person, it would, you know, the point of him being there would be very different.
Yeah, that's why we say we that expression that there has to be a living guru capable of accepting Prabhupada as your guru without being initiated by a living guru is not parampara. You have to have a guru who you can surrender to in the present exchanges. Okay, I guess that's all. Oh, one more question.
Well, I think you're very thought-provoking in class, so it's hard to formulate. Kind of formulate a question here for the friends. Just difficulties. Because I think that you made a point that it encapsulates for me in history that I have to do with working in the present day. And I think we were all guilty of maybe trying to be superhuman, whether it was disciple or guru, or trying to be like Prabhupada. Prabhupada, in one sense, was superhuman as well. And, you know, so we came and surrendered. I thought we were surrendered to some kind of post or some idea, but then we're all learning, I'm starting learning, that it's not like that. And, you know, it's very personal. And that letter that you read it, and I think, oh, brother, or something.
Yeah.
So brilliant, actually, in a sense that making it clear that we're actually trying to learn something else. We're trying to learn what that relationship is. We don't really know. It's like, yes, and I think Shivali made the point that when you have a new relationship, whether it's with Krishna consciousness or with wife and husband, so there's a freshness and an excitement about it.
Yeah.
Then after some time, it's not there anymore. And what do we replace that enthusiasm with?
Yeah.
That's really the point for me. It's like, I have to replace it with something that's gone.
Yeah.
So what he replaced it with, and that letter was very directive, you know, there was knowledge really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Understanding these things.
And I think of words like, maturity and solidity, and say, I'm not sneaking out of the house now and chanting my beads. That's not my thrill. But I'm raising my children, and I'm practicing Krishna consciousness and the best I can. So it's a different world. That's a changing body. It's a former life, and something has to replace it. Yeah, if you don't find it, well, now I'm 40. I'm not 20. So what will I do as a Krishna conscious person to struggle and to be a devotee, keep a temple altar, associate with devotees my age, do some kind of preaching if I can. There are replacements and better replacements to the first thrills of becoming the Krishna consciousness. I heard a tape yesterday. It was really nice, these talks that Shruti Kirti gives of his memories with Prabhupada. He has an amazing memory and very sweet. He really remembers the soft hearted personality of Prabhupada. But when he would tell just a little thing, he was lecturing to young devotees, and they said, what was the first Mahaprasadam that you ate from Prabhupada? And he said, well, Prabhupada, when he would eat oranges, he would eat the whole thing. There'd be nothing left, just the rind. And so the first thing I ate was the rind, and they all went, ooh, ah, ooh. And then they said, what was your first test from Prabhupada? Well, he rang the bell, and when I came in, he said, I just wanted to see how fast you came. Ooh, ah, ooh. Any little thing they would be thrilled by, but it's a little hard to be so ooh ah when you're older, but you can still be pleased and satisfied in Krishna consciousness.
Good example.